listener to the fourth edition of the Zeitgeist Tapes, in which we discuss matters of interest and relevance at the intersection between politics and popular culture. My name's Stephen Fielding, and my colleague is Emma Burnell. Say hello, Emma.
Hi, Steve.
Hello, Emma and listener. Today, we're going to talk primarily about Amano Iannucci's The Death of Stalin, but also because in our World Cup of political fiction, the thick of it, which Amano Iannucci devised and was the kind of presiding genius over, won very easily the World Cup of political fiction. So we thought it'd be quite an interesting opportunity, given that his film is just out and we've just had that competition, to kind of reflect on the film, but also where that sits in his wider canon, as academics such as myself are apt to call things, or his oeuvre, as even more pretentious academics such as myself also refer to the work. But before we do, as is our wont, we want to just pick up on a more contemporary and alive issue that's just been raised since the last Zeitgeist Tapes. And as I'm sure many of our listener would be aware, Harvey Weinstein, the Hollywood producer and general cultural entrepreneur, his behaviour, alleged behaviour, our lawyer has insisted on us putting it, has become public and has raised all kinds of issues. And not only Harvey Weinstein, but also Max Stafford Clarke, the prominent artistic director of the Royal Court in the 1980s and 90s, but also someone who is associated with plays by writers of the left and supportive of many plays by women too. And also, this links to some of the revelations alleged about the Labour MP Jared O'Mara. And this kind of raises various issues that we're going to kick around for a little bit. But principally, it seems to be, to me at least, raise issues about men who were associated in public with the left in all three cases, having in private, in their own private lives, attitudes, and also more than attitudes, their actions, raise questions. There seems to be a contrast, a contradiction between their public politics and their private behaviour, and their attitudes to women, to sexuality, to gays, to all kinds of things which are of interest. And particularly given that Weinstein and Max Stafford Clarke are people associated with film and plays, this seems something that I think Emma and I might be legitimate in discussing. What do you think, Emma?
Yeah, I think it's a very valid topic. When, as you said, what we do is look at where popular culture and politics intersect. And in all three cases, that's been the case, because part of what Mr. O'Mara has been caught out having done is using some fairly gross language on discussion forum boards around bands and music. So this is all a sense of where people who have used their cultural platform to make political points, or people who have an intersection of culture and politics, absolutely misusing those platforms to make life in either the cultural industries or the political world once again a place that is not very safe or welcoming to women.
Yes, I mean there seems to be, they are linked in particular ways, but there's sort of also slightly different, because Weinstein was a Hollywood producer, and he publicly associated and supported, you know, Hillary Clinton, Obama, all kinds of AIDS issues, things like that. But was part of an industry, is part of an industry, which also promotes all kinds of attitudes about the role of men and women and this and that. Very conservative in some senses. Ironically, I don't think the films that he was associated with did that in particular. And some of them were quite radical in their implications.
Yeah, I mean, I think he completely would separate his his understanding of his social behaviour, from his understanding of his political behaviour. And I think that's where many people would take issue, because if you are creating a hostile environment for women in any way, you are part of the problem.
Yeah. I mean, the same with Max Stafford Clarke, in fact, possibly even it's more accentuated, overt. Actually, because he was a radical artistic director associated with all kinds of path-breaking plays and all the right sorts of left-wing playwrights like David Hare, but also promoted many women playwrights as well at a time when, you know, that was not, you know, women playwrights were not as given opportunities as much as they are today. I mean, relatively still less than men. But his personal alleged personal behaviour is in deep contrast to what he was doing publicly and the causes that he was associated with in public. And I think there were some people in terms, you know, Weinstein maybe, him certainly, and Jared O'Mara at least initially, that the idea was that because these guys were playing what some people would have thought was a positive public role, that we shouldn't really attack them, or we should not condone but just overlook some of their private behaviour, because certainly those people on the right would use their private behaviour to undermine their public causes. And obviously that's not really tenable, is it?
Well, it's not tenable, and I mean, I genuinely get baffled by this. I sort of understand the circle the wagons mentality. We all have that to extent. At certain times, we kind of go, oh, gosh, that's one of our guys. I don't want to see anything. I don't want to say anything. Hands, fingers in the ears. My eyes are shut. You know, three brass monkeys. But, we're in a world where that just doesn't work. Yeah, one of the things that internet and mass communications have allowed us to do is make sure that everybody's voice can be echoed. But secondly, it's the most appalling short-termism. Mm. Actually, the more important thing is, this particular scandal isn't great for your politics. But you know what really isn't great for your politics? Being awful. Being a horrible person, being a person who makes other people uncomfortable. And if you don't want your politics, whichever side of the fence you're on, whichever your cause that you're passionate about, to be better, then I don't understand why you spend so much time doing it. And that's what really gets to me about some of the wagon circling. It's like, you know how damaging this is. It's so damaging, and I sometimes wonder, I don't wonder very much at all, I feel like I may know the answer, that if it wasn't sexism, if it was something else, what seems to have ended up with Jared O'Mara finally losing the whip was that there was racism added to the sexism, added to the homophobia.
Right.
So it would just sort of piled on all of the things that you really can't be as someone who's supposed to be on the left.
He basically got top trumps of prejudice there, didn't he? Yes. Well done, Jared, there.
I'm sure there's some ageism thrown in there as well, you know.
Apart from, of course, the inherently racist nature of the metaphor you're using about bringing the wagons together.
that's a fair point. I hadn't really considered where that image but comes from, but presumably it's the
those terrible cowboy films that were all meant to condemn.
Those terrible cowboy films, yes. In which case, you see, I'm just as bad. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to immediately apologise and say, yes, I hadn't considered that metaphor, but you're absolutely right. That is wrong, and I won't do it again. See but how I easy was a... that is?
You've learned something. Maybe our listener has learned something. Well, you're on a journey, but you've had to. You're being attacked by Native Americans who tried to stop you taking that journey, metaphorically speaking. But the point I was going to make was to say it's like you're getting the wagons all together, but you've got one of the. I'm now compounding the error.
I think we should leave the wagons behind now.
But anyway, it's like trying to defend yourself. But you're actually defending an enemy, ultimately, aren't you?
You are allowing I mean, hypocrisy is one of the biggest sort of things that people get caught out for in politics.
Yes.
And we're all human. We all make stupid mistakes. Mm. If the Jared O'Mara stuff had just been a stupid mistake he made 15 years ago, I mean, I still found it quite disgusting and I was pretty grossed out by it. But we are talking about, you know, some of the latest allegations, and they are the ones that he disputes, but they are still out there, mm. are from this year. Yeah, so this is not something that is in a youthful past. I've also been really, really surprised by the number of people who go, oh, well, our attitudes were so completely different then. We're not talking about the 1970s. It's 2002.
Yes. I think, yes. So it is understandable that people of a similar kind of political view might wish to overlook certain actions and condone, not condone, but to overlook because of the fevered nature of the whole partisan nature of politics. But it's understandable, but as you say, it's not really, we shouldn't really allow this anymore. This used to be the case. But in terms of Weinstein, I mean, Weinstein, the allegations all are about his sexual, whatever he was doing to women, and abusing his position of power. Mm. But he was a terrible human being as well. I mean, people, no, nobody said, oh, well, apart from that, he was a nice guy. Yeah. This is someone who was bullying in every respect. And the bullying of women was just the way that the bullying took, the form that it took when it came to women, and it was sexualized. So these are not nice people. But I do wonder that, he's kind of set in train, the revelations of his alleged behaviour, has set in train things about Staffordcott, which I think it is related. We now know things about him because women are coming out and saying things about him. And we know about O'Mara. Maybe that would have happened anyway. In fact, it was being alleged, wasn't it, by Guido Fawkes. But now I understand there's a WhatsApp group of female researchers and various figures within Westminster who are now discussing and outing male politicians of all parties, whose behaviour they're basically warning each other about.
Yeah.
And that will maybe seep into the public domain, and maybe it should. I mean, I'm not sure why. Well, I understand why they're keeping it private, because they've got jobs and careers. But I think maybe the Weinstein thing has set in train a process which it may just become a more general thing, and maybe give women in all kinds of occupations the courage, because it does take courage, clearly, to stand up and to point fingers, and hopefully we'll make that much easier for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also the Labour 2 thing that's been set up for women to anonymously tell their stories about sexual harassment.
Of course,
the Labour
yes,
Party.
Yes.
I remember when the Lord Renard scandal was breaking in the Lib Dems, and I did comment on it a lot, and I very, very, very consciously did not at any point try to make that partisan.
Mm-hmm.
The Lib Dems are like this because they're the Lib Dems and they're useless at this, that and the other, because everybody's aware that this happens in every party. Mm-hmm. And if you try to make this a partisan thing, then you are actually diminishing the problems of that the women are experiencing. And I mean, I find it pretty disgusting that Guido is suddenly pretending to be a bloody feminist.
Well, of course. Yes.
Yeah, and that is just, it's opportunism. Now, I absolutely agree with the editorial stance that Guido has made in above the line, but if Guido really, really cared about this stuff, then he would sort out what happens in his comments every single hour of every single day, because that's one of the worst cesspits of sexism in the political media. So I'm not going to take any lectures from Guido on how I should deal with sexist misogyny and abuse, because frankly he hasn't got a leg to stand on.
Yes, it's and you know, unfortunately, this does cut both ways, doesn't it? So I do remember reading in the Alistair Campbell diaries a conversation that he had with Tony Blair during the height of the accusations, most of which had to prove to be true, of Tory sleaze, which of course included sleazy sexual behaviour, usually directed at women. And Tony Blair once, in his diaries, he reports Tony Blair saying, really, should we really exploit this as an issue? Really? Won't it undermine politics? If we do it this way, and obviously they decided they would.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. It is a matter in which all parties have their issues, and obviously if one party then decides to turn it into a partisan thing, it then makes the other party, when they have to deal with their issues, less likely to deal with them properly, because they'll feel vulnerable, and so it's an attitude which actually doesn't help anybody solve the problem.
No, and absolutely essential to this kind of thing is sunshine. And if you just get locked into the protection of your party above all other things, then the thing that you're not going to welcome is sunshine. Mm. And it's really hard to do. It is really, really hard to do. I mean, I've seen terribly dodgy stuff through the years. I haven't had much of it myself. I was 24 stone most of the time I was working in politics. No one was going to harass me. But I've had the odd moment.
Right.
I've had to put myself in the protection of other women as often. And so I haven't told those stories because they're not my stories to tell. They're the other women's story to tell.
Mm.
But, and once again, I would say that one of the other things that's happening around this is people are factionalising it. So people on the Labour right are going off, it's all momentum.
Yes,
if you think it doesn't happen in your faction, you are wrong too.
Mm.
Get over using the abusive systems of women to make your stupid little factional points.
No, I agree. It's not very edifying whenever somebody tries to use that kind of an issue for their own partisan points, whether it's internal or it's external to a party. I mean, it's an issue that all parties have got, and to exploit it in that way just diminishes the ability of everybody to try to solve the matter. So, I think we've had our say on that.
I think we may have covered that.
Yes, we might want to come back to it at some point, depending on how things develop. But there are other interesting aspects to this, like Weinstein in an industry that promotes a certain attitude towards women, and what it also says about what groups when groups predominate in an industry or in a party. You know, in this case, it's obviously men, but also we may be talking about men of a certain kind from a certain class.
Mm.
This has impacts on and there's an academic called David O'Brien who's looking at how the dominance of certain people from the upper classes in the creative industries just completely changes how they relate to society, but for obvious reasons, you might think. Mm. But we might want to come back to that at some point. But it does raise all kinds of issues, I think, that are relevant to us. But I think now, I was trying to think of a really clever link to this, but listener, I have failed. I can't think.
One of the things that did strike me watching a lot of Imadi Nietzsche's work is that there aren't that many women. Perhaps that's a reflection of the political times. It wouldn't be that easy to put that many female characters into historical drama about the death of Stalin, because there weren't that many women involved.
Yes, and I think the link I would have made had I had it properly in my head was that now we're going to talk about Amano Iannucci's death of Stalin. Now Stalin, of course, had an exemplary public behaviour, but his private behaviour was terrible. But no, I wouldn't have made that remark.
Should we investigate?
Should you shut the fuck up before you get us both killed?
Stalin's dead.
He's dead.
Stalin's dead!
Our general secretary is lying in a puddle of indignity.
Yeah, he's feeling unwell, clearly.
I want to make a speech at my father's funeral.
But no problem.
Technically, yes, but practically.
When I said no problem, what I meant was no problem. Ignore me.
Stalin would have wanted the committee as one.
All those in favor? Carried. You. Unanimously.
We need change.
Well, let's see who can mobilize first.
Oh, seems to be me.
Sneaky little shit.
The race has started. We need to start putting together a plan.
How can you run and plot at the same time?
I have no idea what is going on.
I'm the peacemaker, and I'll fuck up anyone who gets in my way.
Come on! Pay better, you flattering fannies! Get it! Give it! Hit it!
Shoot her before him, but make sure he sees it. Kill him, dump him in the pulpit. I'll leave the rest up to you.
We have to act! I really need your help.
I'm gonna have to report this conversation. Threatening to do harm or obstruct any member of the Presidium in the process of looking at your fucking face. I took Germany. I think I can take a flesh lump in a waistcoat.
No matter what happens, I will never let any harm come to you.
I may as well just shoot myself like mother.
Jesus Christ, did Coco Chanel take a shit on your head?
No, he did not.
Stalin will be loving this.
Don't take it from me.
Good luck, ladies.
You know, all of you can kiss my Russian ass. Don't worry, nobody's gonna get killed, I promise you.
The Death of Stalin, by that's directed by Armando Iannucci and part written by him, as well as the people that he's used on The Thick of It and on Veep, obviously was released last week and has got reviewed across the board. And Armando Iannucci has been interviewed on Channel 4 News and on various media outlets about it. It's difficult to avoid, if you're a certain kind of person, that this film is now out.
Yeah.
And as I said right at the top, The Thick of It was recently voted by our followers as the best political drama. And of course, Armando Iannucci was the leading figure in that. So we thought what we should do is just talk about The Death of Stalin, what we both thought about it, having seen it, and where it maybe links with, maybe contrasts with The Thick of It, and what we might say about the Armando Iannucci view of the world, because he's been variously described. I mean, he's hero worshipped by many journalists, it seems, and many people generally, and is probably now regarded as our most important, our best political satirist. He's way up there. So what he does is of some significance, hence all the reviews and all the attention that the film has got. So I saw it last Friday. You saw it, Emma. Over the first weekend, I think, as well.
I did. Yeah.
So what was your first impression of the film?
I really enjoyed it, but it wasn't at all what I was expecting. I mean, it was a lot more of a historical film than a hysterical film. If you
yes. Have you been working on that?
I have. That just came to me, but I'm quite
brilliant.
Proud of it.
That is good. Well done. Congratulations.
So there were some very, very funny moments. And I think there were some very funny characters. So Rupert Friend as Vasily Stalin was hilarious. You are mostly hair was my favourite line. And Jason Isaacs barnstorming as Georgi Zhukov. Was just for some reason as a Yorkshireman, that they all kept their own accents, which is an interesting. I often watch films that are set in another country with characters who were normally talk to each other in Russian, and it does always occur to me that it's a bit weird that we make them speak English to each other with a very Russian accent, which I can't do clearly. And it's like, why do we do that? But then I'm watching this, and they've all got... So you've got Steve Buscemi and Jeffrey Tambor with American accents, and Jason Isaacs, you know, straight out of Sheffield. And it was a bit jarring, I suppose, at first.
Oh, really? Oh, at first, right.
So it just... Because it took me out of the drama a little bit, just because it's such a different dramatic choice to make than what people would normally do in that kind of film. I mean, once you settled into it, it was fine. But just at first, I was kind of a little bit... it just took me up a level away from the drama because I was sort of confused by that slightly.
Right. Well, I was expecting it because I'd read reviews and whatever. So I knew it was coming and I'd seen the clip. So I think it completely worked. I think it was really much more natural than having them all doing the same cod Rusky accent. Because Russia was a huge country. You know, and it contained many different countries. The USSR contained many different countries, didn't it? So I think that totally worked. I mean, I thought that was that, and it added something to it and just showed you how different they were from different parts of the empire. But I watched it. I enjoyed it. I mean, there were funny bits. I thought there was a balance between, because it's been attacked by you know, boneheaded historians and others who said, oh, it's not, you know, there's something wrong about dealing with this death of you know, basically a mass murderer. And so if you take the Mickey out of his death, you're taking the Mickey out of the people that this man was responsible for the deaths of. But I thought it balanced, you know, the awareness that of how, you know, the bad things that had happened and were about to happen had he not died. And also the scared nature, the paranoid nature of the principal figures as well, as a consequence of that regime. I mean, I thought it was good. It was quite funny in parts, although there was a lot of low comedy. I mean, there's lots of references to men to the, you know, the members of the inner circle when they see Stalin dead on the carpet, and of course he's evacuated his bowels as a consequence of his heart attack, and they're all kneeling down, and then they're all getting urine on their suits. You know, I mean, that's kind of like low comedy, but it kind of works. But the thing is, and while as will hopefully become apparent, I really like Amano Iannucci's work, and I find it, you know, very funny. And in some ways, the thick of it got me interested in the connection between politics and drama and fiction more generally, because I really like the thick of it. I think we should expect more of our greatest living satirist to say something a bit more about the subject that he's doing a film about. I mean, particularly, but not exclusively, because I think he should say other things about British politics than he does, and American politics with Veep. But particularly given the very contentious nature, to put it at its mildest, of the regime that followed 1917, as it turned into the Stalinist kind of regime, and we don't really get anything from him. You know, we get an understanding that this was terrible. We get some kind of humanising of the principal figures, who, you know, some of whom have lost brothers and have had to sign their own brothers' death warrants to remain alive within the system, whose own wives, like in the case of Molotov, whose own wives they think have been executed, but it only turns out they've been in, you know, in prison for about 10 to 15 years. But obviously that's a terrible thing as well. And we are shown some awful things that particularly Beria does. I mean, the abuse of women prisoners and things like that. But other than just saying, well, this is how it was, and wasn't it quite, you know, a bit terrible, but there are some laughs in it. But like I say, I'm sympathetic to the laughs. I don't think it detracts from some of the points that he makes. He doesn't. What's he saying? I mean, what's he really saying, you know, as a satirist, about power, about how it can be corrupted into this kind of thing? You know, is he saying anything about the Stalinist regime? Is he saying anything in general about those that exert authority over us, supposedly in our names, but actually they're abusing us in our own names? It was a mildly diverting, quite pleasant, given the subject, maybe it shouldn't be, you know, a relatively thought-provoking, a not unpleasant experience, if I can quote my friend Andy Mycock, who saw it. I thought it was, and that's, I'll take that phrase. It was not an unpleasant experience, but I wonder if we should expect more. That's my only little take from it.
Yeah, I mean, did I learn a little bit more about that particular moment in history? Yes, I probably did. I've never been one of those people who was more interested in the Fourth International than the Fourth Industrial Revolution. There's a strand of Labour Party people who know far, far too much about the events of 1917 and are thinking far too little about 2017. But I've never been one of those.
I didn't feel it left me thinking deeply about totalitarianism, factional positioning. I mean, it was interesting on all of those things, but it was it was fluffy on those things a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, what's his name? Peter Hitchens wrote in the Daily Mail that it was terrible. You know, the very idea of this film was terrible because, you know, if you mock the death of Stalin, then you're mocking the deaths of the people that the people that died as a consequence of him. And you wouldn't do this about Hitler. So there are some people.
I'm not
that
being funny, but isn't the whole downfall parody thing literally doing that? And it's the world's most popular internet meme.
Oh, well, many people did, in fact, then make that point on Twitter and said, yes, people have done this, and there's Mel Brooks and, you know, about, you know, and all kinds of stuff. But I think there are some people that want to make, I mean, they see Armando Iannucci as some kind of a lefty, which he kind of is in some respects. And they thought that the very idea of a film that makes a joke out of this is kind of almost domesticating Stalin and the regime that he was part of. This is obviously from a very particular part of politics, because they want to make a parallel between Stalin and Hitler. They're obsessed, some people, with saying, yeah, they're the same, they're the same, and you people on the left think Stalin was actually, some aspects of it were quite good. But the thing is, and this is something the film also doesn't do, and maybe we're asking too much of one film, but I think it's not inappropriate to ask it, that, you know, Stalin and the regime that he was part of started in with the 1917 revolution with people who had the best of intentions about how they were going to transform society. It was going to be a utopia. It was going to be wonderful. It's going to be this, it's going to be that. And they ended up with Stalin. And it would have been interesting just to have some kind of reflection in that this was of course this was a terrible regime. Nobody's doubting that. There are very few defenders of Stalin. Well, maybe there are a few defenders of Stalin, but there aren't many. Defenders of Stalin in Britain and the United States and outside the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, would have been interesting to have some kind of reflection, some kind of character that might have done that. And instead, just like he does in his other works, which you might sort of start thinking about, talking about the thick of it, there is one character who kind of stands out. So I don't know if you clocked it, but who actually causes the death of Stalin? What is so this is not a quiz, I should say.
It's Maria.
It's the artist.
Musician. Yeah.
It's the musician. It's the artist who writes a letter that is smuggled into Stalin's office, which he reads, where she condemns him because I think he must have murdered or imprisoned most of her family, and that gives him the heart attack, which obviously kills him. And she stands out. She's kind of the artist that stands alone in this, almost uncorrupted. But everybody else within the political system is, you know, Khrushchev is. They're all part of a system. They're all implicated in it. Even the idiotic Molotov, who actually thinks his wife should have been executed because he believes he really did condemn Stalin, and it was right. You know, they're all implicated in it. There's no, and in some ways you could say, well, Khrushchev, you know, within that system, he could have been turned into a partial hero. But there isn't really anybody in that regime that you would have really wanted to cross the street for, because all of politics is full of idiots, murderers, all, you know, power obsessives, you know, incompetents, people who are not very nice human beings. And that then leads on very neatly to the thick of it, possibly, that the way in which, because I thought one of the weaknesses of the film was it was basically importing the Armando Iannucci shtick to an authoritarian regime. So the template which was set in the thick of it was largely imposed on that. I mean, albeit there were actual murders. I mean, there were horrible acts, which Malcolm Tucker threatens all kinds of horrible acts, which never really happened. I think at most he, in a moment of irateness, he does thump Glenn and bloodies his nose. And there's a bit of pushing and shoving of here, there and everywhere. But there's no actual murder that actually happens. But they're all within the world that Armando Iannucci kind of illuminates. The politicians, the spin doctors, the advisors, Maybe not the civil servants so much, but they're all guilty in various ways, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they are at best incompetent, at worst pretty venal. Not necessarily venal for money, but, you know, power hungry. And power hungry for no purpose.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's in one of the episodes, you know, someone asks, you know, someone is told, you've got to keep your eye on the prize. You've got to keep your eye on the prize. And he asks, well, what is the prize? And Jamie and Malcolm respond, well, we don't know. It's just to keep the other lot out of office.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it.
So I think the thing about, I'm rewatching The Thick of It, which I did for this. Now you watch the whole thing from start to finish, and again, it has moments of absolute hilarity, but not as many as I remember. And it's a lot of the time, it's sort of a grimace of amused recognition rather than a belly laugh.
But that's amused recognition from someone who's got experience of that inside world of Westminster.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, there's some stuff I think that is absolutely hilarious. That are just little details. Like, when they do the conference episode, remember when they go to conference?
Well, that's when Glenn gets thumped, gets hit in the face, isn't it? Yes.
And they have different passes. So they have two or three or four passes, depending on where they've got access to. Now, that's not quite what happens at conference, because at conference you have different coloured passes. But, again, it is an absolute macho, I've got a better pass than you. I've got a red pass, that's hilarious kind of thing. And, yeah, so I thought that tiny little details, and just in the background, no one even really mentions it, but it was perfectly describing that sort of one-upmanship that you just get a lot in politics, and is exemplified very well in The Thick of It, that kind of macho competition thing.
No, I think when Armando Iannucci does his stuff, I mean, it is finely observed, because it is based on, you know, interviews, you know, the research is, I was going to say granular, but people tend to say granular now about all kinds of things. it's a terrible cliche. But that nitty gritty, that kind of little thing, and then he turns it into something. But it's more the more kind of stepping back from things that I wonder about, because this is, he is concerned about politics. He, in the last election, he did write things and was quite active in trying to get young people to vote. Clearly, he was very successful in that regard. But in 2015, I think he did the same thing. You know, he wants people to participate. The Thick of It was motivated by his kind of moral disdain for Tony Blair and New Labour for allegedly lying, overblowing the case for getting involved in the Iraq war. So he is a political person. He does want democracy to prosper. He's not one of those kind of Tory anarchists that just wants to pull the house down and they don't really care what happens. They just want to take the mickey out of politics. He does claim subsequently that he does differentiate, The Thick of It and Veep do differentiate between the advisors, the ones that tell the politicians they have to do certain things, and the politicians themselves. He says that he's actually quite sympathetic to politicians, and he has said,
I hate
to
see what he was like when he didn't like them.
Well, I know that they're human beings, and that, you know, they're trying. You know, and the thing is, if you do watch it quite carefully, there are moments when that is clear. You know,
absolutely.
Particularly Nicola Murray. When Nicola Murray, and maybe because she's a woman and therefore is treated in a different way, I can't say. But when she joins the team, she is treated in a slightly different way, and she is also given the opportunity to stand back a little bit and to critique Malcolm, particularly in the early stages when, you know, he basically starts attacking and haranguing as he would do everything else. And she just says, well, you know, but this is just men shouting. You know, what are you doing? And she, at one point, I think she says, this is like being in a boy's toilet, trapped in a boy's toilet. So it's highlighting the kind of the maleness of it, and a certain kind of male as well. It's not every man is like Malcolm Tucker and Jamie. And so there is some space for saying things. And her life is also shown, you know, when she has to sacrifice her one of her children to, she has to send them to a sort of sink comprehensive rather than a posher school that she was, your private school. And even when she's got this fancy chair in her office, and Malcolm says, you can't have that. You know, you can't have that. If, you know, if the Daily Mail gets hold of this, you know, they'll flay you alive. But you are a human dartboard that, you know, people could just throw darts at. And so there are moments of that. But I bet if you ask most people whether they notice them, I bet they just say, well, it's just condemning all politicians, the whole political class. They're all the same. It's too subtle, really. If he wants to really make that point, it's a very weak point that's made, I think, in the thick of it.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, that's sort of how we kind of set up the final of the World Cup of political telly, because we'd whittled it down. Well, our audience, our voters, had whittled it down from 32 to two. And it was the thick of it versus the West Wing, or as I put it, British cynicism versus American idealism. There are moments of humanity, and I think you'd need to have that to just keep it going for as long as, because otherwise you're basically just, and while watching Peter Capaldi swear is magnificent, I mean, nobody swears like Malcolm Tucker. Even so, that could not sustain four series. They have some subtle differences with the Tories, but they were a bit too alike. They were a bit too interchangeable when they took over DOSAC, which is the imaginary department that seemed to be somewhere between the Home Office and CLG, as far as I could tell. Sorry, Communities and Local Government.
Local government, yeah.
The Stuart Pearson character, who is quite clearly that awful guy who used to advise David Cameron, Steve Hilton,
yes.
And Roger Allam, who's probably your sort of classic Ken Clark type Tory.
Yes.
Patrician, doesn't want to, you know, wants to cut taxes and very little else.
Well, and enjoy life. You know, do as little as possible.
And the tensions between those two approaches of and Stuart's appearance at the inquiry is absolutely hilarious, because it turns out that he just cannot turn it off. He cannot just say, I am a media advisor. He's got to be a solutions architect, or whatever they call themselves.
Yeah, the end, the last episode of the whole series is really interesting, because they basically have a kind of a mock-up of the Leveson inquiry, but it's an inquiry into leaks, the culture of leaks.
Well, it's actually the penultimate episode, isn't it? Because the last episode, he gets his revenge on Malcolm. Malcolm goes to jail.
Right. Ah, right, of course, yes. The penultimate, not the ultimate.
The penultimate episode where they're doing the inquiry, which was the double-length episode.
Yeah. So Malcolm is sort of obviously brought up, and it's revealed that's why he goes to jail, isn't it? That he basically leaked someone's personal national health data, which ultimately leads to this person killing themselves. But he has a kind of defence of what he does, which I think... I don't know whether we were meant to believe his defence of what he was doing and his whole kind of being and his own kind of, you know, being a spin doctor.
Shall we have a quick listen to that now?
Yeah, why don't we?
I am obliged to remind you, Mr. Tucker, that you are under oath, and if you lie to this inquiry, it may result in a criminal prosecution.
Sorry, please don't insult my intelligence by acting as if you're all so naive that you don't know how this all works. Everybody in this room has bent the rules to get in here, because you don't get in this room without bending the rules. You don't get to where you are without bending the rules. That's the way it is. Let me tell you this. The whole planet's leaking. Everybody is leaking. You know, everyone's spewing up their guts onto the internet, putting up their their relationship status and photos of their vajazzles. We've come to a point where there are people, millions of people, who are quite happy to trade a kidney in order to go on television and to show people their knickers, to show people their skid marks, and then complain to OK Magazine about a breach of privacy. The exchange of private information, that is what drives our economy. But you come after me because you can't arrest a landmass, can you? You can't cuff a country. You might as well just go and go, you can't lynch that guy there, can you? But you decide that you can sit there, you can judge, and you can ogle me like a page to Gill. You don't like it. Well, you don't like yourself. You don't like your species. And you know what? Neither do I. But how dare you come and lay this at my door? How dare you blame me for this, which is the result of a political class which has given up on morality and simply pursues popularity at all costs. I am you and you are me.
So when I first, and subsequently sort of watched that, I thought, actually, this is what they maybe should have done right at the start, really, because at one level, at the thick of it, was blaming the politicians for their own kind of position. I mean, including the media as well, but they were basically out there on a limb, and were basically, there were no other forces to be blamed for why they were like they were. And yet Malcolm in that speech says, well, we're just part of the bigger picture. You know, politics is part of the wider culture. You basically are responsible for us being like we are.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I, what that did to me is actually that echoed something from a Dennis Potter play from 1965 called Vote for Nigel Barton.
That's funny because I took a more recent, well, not that much more recent now, but for me, it was the Colonel Jessop moment from A Few Good Men.
Which I haven't seen, so you need to explain it to me and our listener.
Well, A Few Good Men is by Aaron Sorkin, and it's a quite complicated story about a Marine dies on Guantanamo Bay base in Cuba. This is pre-9/11, so it wasn't. It's not about sort of any of the issues that were brought up after that. But there was this supposed disciplinary measure used called a code red, and they were ordered to give him a code red by the command chain coming from Colonel Nathan Jessop, which is played by a utterly scenery chewing Jack Nicholson. And this ends up in a court case, and the people who are defending the guys who actually gave the code red, which led to the death of the Marine, it was an accidental death, but it was done through this process. Right near the end, in order to make sure that they are let off, because it was through the chain of command, Tom Cruise, as the prosecuting lawyer, has to get Jack Nicholson to admit that he gave the order. And he does. And he pushes him. And then Jack Nicholson says, I want you want the truth. And
you can't handle the truth.
You can't handle the truth. That's where that's from.
That's where that's from, right.
And he's saying, I do this and you want me doing this. And you know in your heart of hearts you want me doing this. So you liberals who pretend that you don't want this tough protection, actually you sleep better every night because I'm on that wall standing between you and communism.
Well, the thing that brought to mind is this scene in this play, TV play from the 1960s, about an idealistic Labour candidate, and the person who is evil and cynical and wants him to do all the base and nasty things in politics and says he isn't interested in policy, it's just getting the vote out, however you do it, is the agent. And so the agent is defined with all the worst aspects of politics. But at the very end, the agent turns to the camera and says, why do you think I'm like this? You know, I'm not really like this. I used to be an idealist too. Mm-hmm. You, the electorate, you, the viewers, and your stupid, your racism, you're this, you're that. this is why I'm like this, because you're like that. So he's implicating the viewer in all the terrible, you know, the very cynical view of what politics was actually like. And actually, now I'm thinking about it, there's another instance in one of the House of Cards TV adaptations, in which the Prime Minister, Urquhart, by this point, has ordered, which is an echo of a real event in which the British military go and kill IRA suspects on Gibraltar, I think it is, that the military go in and they assassinate these people who are suspected of being IRA terrorists. And then we're all meant to think, this is terrible. And then Urquhart looks up and says, you condemn it, but you, this is what you wanted. This is what you need, you know. And so it's very similar, but it's very, very rare, extremely rare, when in a political drama or a drama of any sort, like A Few Good Men, where the characters who are not meant to be good characters implicate the audience and make them feel uneasy and say, you're part of this. It's not a spectacle. You're part of this, and this is real. And that kind of is what Malcolm was doing at the very, very end.
Yeah.
And I, you know, by that point, I wonder if, but by that point, I think the message, whatever the message was about politics, a very cynical message really about politics, had probably been implanted. And people don't, you know, it was a moment, but most of it was about the politicians are to blame, and the people that they employ around them. They are to blame for why politics is so bad.
Yeah. And I mean, we do get a few occasions where the general public are awful too. I mean, there's
in the thick of it.
I mean, no one comes out of the thick of it very well. You know, when they do meet the public just shout abuse at them in a way that is not exactly helpful or helping them to pursue the case. And there's the woman who keeps going on about her mother's pets.
Oh yes, the Welsh woman. Yes, who's she? But the thing is about that particular episode, which is one of the first episodes of The Thick of It. I mean, I've watched that quite a few times, and I've shown it to students who do my course at University of Nottingham, ladies and gentlemen. And so I've seen it, like, I've just seen it now about three times just in the last couple of weeks. And I've seen it like maybe 20, 30 times. I've lost count. So I know that episode back to front. And it's a terribly hopeless episode because, first of all, it's evoking Sharon Story's confrontation with Tony Blair in 2001. And it also evokes, you know, the John Prescott punch as well. But the significant thing is this woman has got a real problem. And it's a problem that reflects the reality of life. You know, her mother is in a care home and she's not being cared for properly. So she has to, as she keeps telling the minister, you know, well, she keeps asking the minister, have you ever cleaned up your own mother's piss? And she asks it again and again and again, because, as she points out, there are the healthcare staff there, you know, there aren't enough nurses, you know, they're all not trained, there's hardly anybody there, so she has to do it. And she's been sent mad because nobody is solving the problem of her mother in that very unfortunate position. So she's been sent mad, and that's why she's asking the minister and everybody else, have you ever cleaned up your own mother's piss? And so, but she's nuts. She, you know, and so they can't solve it. They don't want to solve it anyway, because for them, it's an embarrassing issue and it's all going to be across the news and they don't want that. The people responsible for the news, they're not interested in her issue specifically. They just want shots of the minister looking like, as the editor says, looking like a tit. You know, this is what we want. We want to see politicians look really bad. That's our object. Mm. And so what it is, it shows a polity in which there is no hope. There is this problem. The woman can't articulate it. She's been sent mad because she can't solve it. The ministers aren't interested in it. And the journalists aren't interested in reporting it. So she ends up ringing up Ollie, isn't it? Randomly, just asking him, have you ever cleaned up your own mother's, you know, you can finish that line. And so it's a really depressing view of politics. And what that dramatises or brings to a point is, and for the series as a whole, and for Armando Iannucci's representation of politics as a whole, there is no hope.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it is really unfair in the same way that the West Wing is too kind to politicians sometimes, certainly politicians who are Democrats.
Yeah.
The Thick of It
although everyone in Westminster adored it, I mean, you know, everyone watched it, and everyone was like, oh, it's so true. And it was, yeah, to an extent, you know, it is so true that office politics is office politics, and office politics is magnified in politics itself. But actually, nobody ever told us why they were there, except possibly Glenn and his son, who had learning difficulties, and that was clearly something that Glenn was quite passionate about.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
But then get screwed over by his minister and mate, because they want to do the opposite of what Glenn thinks they should do for children with learning difficulties. And he just lets that happen. That just sort of washes over, and then it's the next week. I never got a sense from any of them as to why they work in these horrible jobs that, you know, take all their life and time, and you know, they spend their lives being abused by Malcolm, running around after ministers they don't particularly like, or being ministers that they don't particularly like because they have to become the people that they don't want to be. Why are they doing it? You know, and that I feel is it's where it falls down for me slightly.
Yeah.
Because if you're in the thick of it, without the capitals, then what you actually do quite a lot is talk about the things you really care about and the things that you got into politics to do and the reason that you have taken your, sadly, all too often Oxbridge degree and haven't gone off to the city to make your fortune, but have actually decided to do something for the social good. And I'm not someone who feels that we shouldn't be a little cynical about politics and politicians, but only if we can balance that with some realism too.
Yes.
And some positive realism.
And that's kind of my main critique of Ianucci, is that he doesn't really allow that to be there. I mean, it's there in little bits. Mm. I mean, Ollie, when he's first called over to number 10, he thinks he's going to be asked about his PhD in some aspect of social policy. And then he's distributed that very quickly, because the only reason he's been asked over to number 10 is because I've heard he's going out with some conservative advisor and they want to get some intelligence on what she knows. And so he's slightly disappointed, but then he moves off and he does all the things that they ask him to do. So it's a very brief moment of disappointment on his part. But so they do, but it's overwhelmed by that structural cynicism that there is really no way out from this. And yet, at the same time, as I pointed out, Ianucci, as a private person, wants politics to work, wants democracy to work, things have to change. But in his own work, he doesn't give any hope to the viewer what are we meant to latch onto here? Where is the opportunity? So there's a bit of I think there's a massive contradiction between him as a kind of a political figure, such as he is, and him as an entertainer and a political satirist. And this comes back to the reason why I'm slightly disappointed in Omano. But I like him. I think it's funny. But I'm slightly disappointed in what he's done, in the sense that he's meant to be a political satirist, and a political satirist is meant to offer, you know, are you just going to be destructive and say this is all terrible?
Mm.
Well, but that's what Nigel Farage says. You know, that's all kinds of populists say. This is what Donald Trump says. So maybe if you want the system to work, democracy to work, you should, within your own work, have found some way to express that, even not necessarily in a preachy way or a West Wing way, but in some way, shape or form, you could have had some character or some instance where there was something that would counter Malcolm. But no, that's no, for reasons maybe of entertainment, get more sweary stuff in, that's not the way you went. But there is a contradiction, I think, there, that between what he wants democracy to be like and how he depicts it. But now I understand he's going off, his next project is going to be something to do with science fiction. So he's clearly, you know, having done history, Russian history, with the death of Stalin, now he's going into the future. And maybe he's, maybe he's fed up doing all this stuff about politics, because he'd been doing it for a long time. So
yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, the thick of it wasn't really the first, because I mean, even on television, there was Friday Night Armistice that had quite a lot of political content.
Yeah, and the Day to Day, which he was involved with too. Yeah. Although it was about the media, there was a lot of politics in that too.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see what comes of this new project. But I think we've given Mr. Armano Iannucci, who I think we both agree is a very funny man, and we're
absolutely
very grateful.
And yeah, I mean, I'm
very grateful for his work.
These are all, this is a work, these are works that I have enjoyed. Yeah. You know, it's not, I wouldn't have spent my Saturday night going to see Death of Stalin if I didn't think I would enjoy it.
No, of course not.
But I do, yeah, but like with any piece of work, there are critical questions to be asked at the same time as having a giggle at phrases like, well, it's not easy peasy lemon squeezy, it's difficult, difficult, lemon difficult, which I think is one of the best lines in The Loop, which was obviously the film made.
In The Loop, right, yes. Right, so I think it's time for us to say wave goodbye to our listener and wish them well.
Thank you very much again.
And hope they'll come back in about a month's time when we'll be talking about something that we haven't yet decided upon, but anyway.
And if you have any ideas, do feel free to get in touch with us through Twitter. We are at ZT Podcast. So if you've got something that you think we should be covering, do let us know.
And I should acknowledge the artistry of Lord Wood of Anfield, who has provided us with our theme tune. And also to remind our listener that this has been a Political Human production.
So mine is a podcast by one of our listeners, Emma Burnell.
Brilliant.
She's a fantastic freelance journalist, political writer. She's doing the Zeitgeist tapes. It's a once-a-month podcast, so you're not going to get overloaded with it.
Yep.
She presents it with Steve Fielding, a professor of Manchester. And it's just great. They just look at what's in pop culture at the moment, and they talk about it in a political slant.
What's it called again?
It's The Zeitgeist Tapes.
With Emma Burnell.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Good tip. She's brilliant.
She's fab.